Chapter 29. November 2057. On the day the FIS conference opened, Fred Bowles' team were to fly in from Gateshead, boarding an RAF helicopter from the pad on the roof of Government House. From there, it would be a direct hop across the Middle Sea to New Aberdeen. They were to leave at 7 in the morning. Another conference, Tash thought. Another all-nighter to prepare. Another damn chopper flight on no sleep. But if you missed the flight, you didn't go. At the appointed hour, gathering for the flight, they all took shelter in, as Tash said to Mel, what had to be the world's most primitive departure lounge. Little more than a shack on this flat grass-covered roof, with no facilities save a lavatory, a water dispenser, and not enough hard metal chairs. It was cold too, and the building frame creaked and banged ominously as yet another autumn storm barreled in from the North Atlantic. At least the cloudy sky didn't trigger her post-blink phobias. "Look on the bright side," Mel said, heavily sarcastic. "At least you came prepared." Mel herself, Tash observed resentfully, was dressed sensibly, in sweater and jeans under a thick hooded waterproof winter coat, whereas the best Tash could do was a heavy coat over a business suit. But then Mel wouldn't be pitched into diplomatic meetings the minute they landed at Dogger Island. Even if her boss would be, the Astronomer Royal visibly uncomfortable in her own voluminous parka and padded trousers. "Anyhow, here comes our flight." The chopper, buffeted back and forth by the rooftop wind, came down with a roar that rattled the windows of the boxy shelter. Tash could see a human pilot at the controls, still standard protocol in military vehicles, and a not uncommon sight now, post-blink, even on civilian craft. Under a ragged magnetosphere and ionosphere, smart systems weren't to be trusted as they had once been. Once the chopper was down, clamps pushed out to secure it to the roof and doors were thrown open. A couple of squaddies briskly lined up the passengers and began passing them through the doors. Each of them one scanned quickly for one last security check. The wind on the roof, when Tash was exposed to it as she crossed the few metres to the chopper steps, was like a punch in the face, and it clutched at her coat, making her stagger. More post-blink turbulence, she knew, as the atmosphere and oceans continued to slosh 11 months after the great jolt of that sunless day, all boiling down to this viciously cold wind in the small hours of a November Gateshead morning. A squaddie had to help drag Tash up the couple of steps into the machine. But once she was inside, and once the last passenger was boarded and the door banged closed, once she sank back into a Skylon-type smart seat which enfolded her like a parent's hug, she felt her eyes slide shut. She heard murmurings around her, Mel talking to Marlowe, Grace and Fred speaking softly. But soon the conversation died down. Fred had promised that there would be no work on the flight. They had done all they could. They had worked flat out for days, and even overnights. They needed to be as fresh as possible as they faced the task that would swallow them up for more days and nights. A task that would start as soon as they landed. Tash fumbled on heavy headphones so that only the deepest bass sounds of the engine reached her. And as the chopper thrust into the sky, as she was pushed back gently into her seat, she fell into a deep sleep. She woke once during the flight. Mel touched her shoulder, pointed. Tash stirred and looked out of the window. The sky was unusually clear, and she could see that the helicopter was flying over a great dam, a straight line across grey, choppy waters where fragmented morning sunlight glimmered. Tash tried to think it through. That is the North Dyke, right? 500 kilometres of dam between Scotland and Norway. New Aberdeen is far south of here. We're 100 kilometres off course. No. Well, yes. Take it easy. We're having to skirt a big storm system. We won't be late. Everybody else has the same issues getting there. And they are already rescheduling the conference sessions. I just thought you'd like to see this. I once drove over the English Channel dike. But that's only a couple of 100 kilometres long, if that. Tash stared, fascinated. This kind of experience reminds me I spend too much of my life in stuffy, windowless rooms. Is the water already a little bluer on this side of the dike? The south side? Maybe. It's hard to tell through these tinted windows. The middle sea, the enclosed bit of the North Sea, is turning into a big freshwater lake, slowly. Like earlier enclosures in the Netherlands, there'll be a whole new ecosystem ultimately, as well as a defence against rising sea levels. Tash smiled. They closed off a whole sea. Tremendous project. Yeah, just think. To a North Sea cod, we humans must seem to have the power of Galaxias. Not entirely a comfortable thought. And she sank back into sleep for a blissful few minutes more. The next time she woke, she was over New Aberdeen. Dogger Island itself was another extraordinary sight. Huge wind turbine towers thrust out of the water, each, she knew, as tall as the Eiffel Tower. A forest of tall, smartwood buildings fenced in by a network of artificial islands and sea walls. The sea had always been shallow here, only tens of metres deep, and now the bed had been sculpted and raised up by human actions. Mel leaned past her again, looking out. What a sight! Heroic stuff from the last generation, and a rare cooperation between Scotland and England. Maybe, but never mind the past. There. Tash pointed down to an array of buildings, smartwood peppered with aluminium and glass and surrounded by airfields and runways. There is where, in the next couple of days, we might make a little history of our own. Or not. Or not, Tash conceded. The New Aberdeen Conference Centre, the NACC, co-owned by the Dutch, English and Scottish governments, and under the nominal management of the Royal Societies of London and Edinburgh, was a series of domes, surrounded by covered walkways leading to landing strips and pads, and with the tremendous turbine towers, like a forest, above them. The big domes enclosed conference facilities, plus a range of top-class hotels and leisure outlets. All of which was designed, as Tash knew from government briefings, to entice distinguished guests from overseas to linger a little longer and spend a little more. Tash herself had never been here apart from a single one-day helicopter trip years back. Her father had said it was ridiculous, like a huge James Bond movie set. Well, there was a casino. And it was profitable, or had been before the blink. It was certainly striking. Further out, Tash saw, the fringe of this man-made island was indented by docks, and a sprawling company town, New Aberdeen itself. The name a reminder of the folk who had built this place, and now largely inhabited and maintained it. A huge transfer from the mainland city of the energies, expertise, even some of the infrastructure of the abandoned offshore oil industry. And these days the old oil fields were, ironically, being used for carbon sequestration, black stuff being pumped back into the undersea geology. But there wasn't going to be a lot of time for sightseeing this time. Not like that day with her father, poking around Neolithic artifacts retrieved from a seabed that had once been dry land, or peering at tanks of the gen-enged fish that populated this enclosed sea during its transition from salt to fresh. She checked her watch. The conference session should already have started, unless the timetable had changed again. The chopper set down smoothly. The passengers were disembarked quickly. A military escort and civilian security greeted them at the first of the domes they entered, where they were able to freshen up, dump their flight gear, and open their luggage for inspection. Some changed their clothes hastily, in closet-sized changing rooms before the luggage was taken off to sleeping quarters they would have to find later. They briskly formed up into teams, Tash joining the ones surrounding Charlie Marlowe and Fred Bowles, and dispersed to their assignments. Fred being a government minister, his very first stop was a roomy meet-and-greet reception area, under a huge semi-transparent dome, brightly lit. This space was crowded with suits already, and many with glasses in hand, though it wasn't long past noon. Tash recognised politicians from around the world, industrialists, journalists, even an expensive soccer player, who had turned out to be an influencer of opinion concerning the impact of Galaxias, a great referee in the sky, as she had put it. Floating drones served more drinks. Tash grabbed a glass of water. Somewhere, a piano played. As soon as they were spotted, people crowded around Bowles and Marlowe. But the pair knew the drill. They pushed forward like, Tash thought vaguely, oceanic metaphors in her mind. The prow of a trawler, with their attendants, including herself, and would-be petitioners trailing behind like opportunistic seagulls. And Grace Butterworth, with other guards, kept a wary eye out. Tash found herself staring up at the domed roof itself. Huge Dutch, English and Scottish flags were suspended from a frame below a wooden ceiling, along with the blue fizz flag, the flags of other nations forming a background array. She knew that this ultra-modern building was ultra-smart, constructed almost entirely of enhanced wood, and capable of maintaining its interior climate almost exclusively by feeding off the energy flows from the sun above and earth below. A smart, modern background behind a chaotic human foreground. And, post the blink, it all seemed unreasonably fragile, like a vast bubble. After a while, Marlowe came bustling up to Tash and Mel, bearing a glass of cola. From the look of it, her suit was even more uncomfortable than Tash's. I need a break already. Quite a show, isn't it? I've already bounced off half a dozen conversations, like gas molecules in a box. It's pretty exhausting, actually. But maybe it's working. I'm finding out that there are sidebar discussions planned on a range of topics, not just the Galaxias response initiatives. It's as if people have been saving stuff up for this big session. Let's get it all aired while the influencers are gathered, and with the heads of state themselves on the way. Tash replaced her own empty glass of water with a full one from a solicitous drone. What kind of stuff so far? I'll brief Fred if I can. You name it, Marlowe said. More post-blink mitigation measures, of course, especially the large-scale international stuff. The geologists are saying we must expect a big volcanic episode sometime in the next few years. Dwarfing Rainier, I mean, and even the Hypercane undersea event. Preparations are underway for that in outline, though the likely location hasn't been pinned down yet. Major climate shifts to come, in general, as the new yearly cycle settles down. Deserts and wet zones on the march. They're expecting an upsurge in migration worldwide. That's not good, Tash murmured. Not to have that back again. Marlowe shook her head. Well, let's hope we can use the experience of the past few decades to do it better this time. Oh, hell. A world in turmoil, again. But then, when is it not? That's even before we get to think about Galaxias itself, and what that means for our future. And here are gathered the brains who are going to manage it all, or not. All in their suits and thousand-pound dresses. Well, all we can do is our best. She looked around sourly and stepped a little closer to Tash. But, you know, functions like this, it does remind me of what I always disliked about the upper echelons of science and society, at least in England, where it merges with the money, you know? Old money especially. Summer parties at some august hide-bound institution or other, full of people who are comfortable in dinner suits and noisy small talk over the canapes, and talk probably entirely devoid of intellectual content, if you were to bother to analyse it. I'm the Astronomer Royal. At least I got that post on merit, and not because of which school I went to. Well, I think so. And I think I can deal with it, frankly. I can get business done. But I do resent it all, she added grimly. It would be nice to think that this enormous shake-up we face will reform society for good. But if climate change didn't manage it, oh, hell. Don't listen to me. Anyhow, come on, you two. Work to do. Follow me. She drained her cola, threw the glass over her shoulder, and walked on. Tash cringed, but the glass, actually probably unbreakable, lightweight, clear wood, was fielded by a speeding drone, as Marlowe had surely known it would be. Mel went to follow, but Tash hung back. You're asking for me, too, No, wait. Sorry, Charlie. I ought to stay close to Fred. That's my job. Marlowe stopped and called back. Not for the moment. I got you a pass. Check if you like. Grace knows. Tash shook her head, baffled. This is a Fizz Heads of Government conference on humanity's future relationship with a superpowered galactic intelligence. I'm here with a government minister. What can be more important than that? Marlowe smiled. Personal connections, that's what. Fred Bowles would agree. Communication beyond words. Mel asked, connections to who? To Wu Shi. That stopped Tash in her tracks. Shi? He's not even here. He's on the lodestone. But his mother's here. One of the keynote speakers, if not the key. Due to speak this afternoon, I think. I know that, Tash said. Of course I know that. What about her? Right now I have her locked in a room. Not literally, I add for the benefit of the security bugs listening in. But she is in there, and I want you to... shut-ins. In-jokes, Mel said. Whatever. To come help me talk to her, persuade her. Look, I know you cornered her in Edinburgh that time and got her to open up a little about the Chinese plans. I know she let Mel poke around that replicator technology prototype on the moon, although that was already out in the open. And I know she showed you around that setup in Oregon, although the Americans had crawled over that already. It's as if she's trying, maybe not even consciously, to reach out to us. So let's help her. Tash glanced at Mel, uncomfortable. We have tried to get Yan and Shi to connect, mother and son. Marlowe sighed. I'm sorry to seem cynical or manipulative, but this is too big. We've been pussyfooting around since the blink. This conference is about getting the Chinese on side, any way we can. I agree with Bowles and the rest of them over the significance of that. And Wu Yan has always presented an opportunity to apply some leverage. Because she shows up, she speaks to us, however enigmatically. And so we have to do this, however cynical or manipulative it might seem. So come on, I'll lead the way. She pointed a finger at a drifting droid. You, follow. Bring cola. And she walked off again. Mel took Tasha's hand as they walked. Time to bow to the inevitable, kid. A couple of lifts and a moving walkway later, they followed Charlie into a small, luxuriously appointed side office. Or maybe you could call it a hotel suite with business facilities. Bedrooms were visible through open doors, and there was even a small kitchen space. What looked to Tash like a policewoman, Chinese, opened the door to them. A little bubble of Chinese security within the British-Dutch lockdown, she thought. Wu Yan was sitting alone at a table. Glasses and a water decanter before her, like a barricade. Alone aside from that lone cop who stood by the door, watchful. Yan, tall, elegant as ever, was dressed in a sober brown robe, serene. Tash always found her hugely impressive, she realised, even if Yan was nothing like her impulsive, emotional son. For her part, Yan seemed surprised to see Mel and Tash walk in after Charlie, evidently somewhat confused. She made the best of it, stood up, and welcomed them with brief embraces, carefully monitored by the cop. Then, with the drinks-bearing drone outside, the cop closed the door. Come, please, sit. Mel and Tash brought up more chairs, and they, with Charlie, sat opposite Yan. Yan glanced around. Oh, no drinks, save for this water. Would you care for coffees? Tash shrugged. Marlowe and Mel both nodded. Please. Yan looked at the cop by the door. Would you mind? The cop opened the door and murmured to the drone that had followed Marlowe, still hovering outside, and it scooted off. When the drone had gone, the cop resumed her silent station at the door, staring straight ahead. Thank you, Marlowe said with a grin. That's a promising start. In terms of international cooperation, sorry to be abrupt, and sorry for, well, all this, Yan. Wu Yan looked stern. This meeting was scheduled with you alone, and in walk these two. I thought they might help. Look, this was all my idea. Mea culpa. Not approved by Fred Bowles, even. I just thought it was best to try to talk to you before the bun fight. Sorry if it feels like a subterfuge. Yan folded her arms. It feels like emotional blackmail, once again, over my son. A soft tap on the door. The cop opened it and let in the drone, which hovered by the table bearing a tray, coffee decanter, cream, cups. They sat silently as the drone settled over the table, deposited its load, and poured out precise cups, responding to requests for cream and sugar. Once again it left, through the door held by the cop. The cop resumed her station. "Well, here we are," Yan said. "To talk about what?" Marlowe leaned forward. "Come now. Professor Wu, as you know, this afternoon is the key to the conference. Your presentation will immediately follow the pioneer pitch. That's the two big events, everything lined up, before we all get conference fatigue. The crucial events we need to get done before the leaders show up." Marlowe steepled her fingers. "Now, look, I'm an astronomer, not a diplomat. But I do want this monster chinwag to go as well as possible. We have global problems. We need a global response. And in particular, right now, I think we need global consent to the high-profile initiatives regarding Galaxias that are being proposed, and one of which, in a sense, you represent." Yan smiled. "Represent is the right word. I represent only at best. We have spoken of this before. I cannot speak for the whole team I work with, let alone the relevant government ministries and the national leadership. But if I have been brought here to provide information, I know you are aware of our openness on specifics. Why, I myself hosted Mel here on an inspection of our solar panel experiment on the moon, and you had access to the Oregon site." "Right," Marlowe said. "You allowed limited but appropriate access. It's the way you do things, it seems, normally. Dribbling out fragments. But, Professor Wu, now is not a normal time. Today is not a normal diplomatic conference. This isn't even a normal, extraordinary international conference about a global crisis, if you see what I mean. Because we are moving fast now, aren't we? The American spacecraft program is ramping up very visibly. Your industrial experiments on the moon and elsewhere are gathering momentum. All this in plain view of Galaxias, of the Lurker, we have to assume." Marlowe leaned forward, spread her hands on the table. "We need to get this right. We have to assume that every move we make will be taken by Galaxias, to be made on behalf of all of us, all humanity. Because that's the way it would think and act." Yan nodded. "So you wish us both to be open, the Chinese, the Americans. That's what you are saying." "Yes, you have told us much. If not in any great detail. But you still aren't telling us your goal. Nothing makes sense without it. Now's the time. This conference is your opportunity, because it doesn't get any more senior than this. Don't just talk about the next technical phase. Tell us about the strategy, the ultimate objective. Just as Serena Jones has revealed Pioneer 14, now that she is confident in it. As of yesterday, you can look up the damn thing on your phone. If you are prepared to speak, then we can open a dialogue with your political leaders. Be as open as you can be." "I agree, of course." That took Charlie aback, evidently. "You do?" Tash shook her head. "Hold on. You don't know diplomats, Charlie. I think there's a big fat but in there." Yan smiled. "And that is an expression she has picked up from you, Tash, for better or worse. I think we should try to be open as much as possible. Not for the benefit of Galaxias, for the benefit of humanity. I must say, however, you hint at mistrust of the Chinese project because of secrets at its heart. And I have admitted to such secrets. But we believe what we are doing is too important to reveal yet to foreigners. Even if our work should ultimately protect them too. But the Pioneer team are mistrusted too, despite their apparent openness. You must know that. Around the world, the questions are asked. What do the Americans really want? Will they try to make some deal with the ETI even? Will they seek to steal or monopolize its technology to gain a commercial, political, even military advantage back home? Now, you and I know this is nonsense. That as an envoy, Jones's little crew will have about as much sway as Pocahontas did at the English court. But nobody said such fears of a collaboration between America and Galaxius, a betrayal of humanity, have to be based in logic. Charlie nodded. So you agree that openness is desirable? She sighed. Of course. But despite your eloquence, Professor Marlowe, for reasons we have discussed many times, I cannot go into further details. Tash leaned forward. Thanks to a leak from Grace Butterworth, she had one card to play in this discussion. But we, the English government, do know one thing about the project. The internal code name for these gadgets you are building, you call them Acorns. Marlowe's eyebrows rose. Really? Once again, I'm glad I dragged you two in. Mel frowned. I didn't know that. Sorry, Tash said. I wasn't supposed to leak that to anyone, not even you. Mel shook her head. Why acorns? Well, what is an acorn? The seed of an oak tree. One acorn produces one oak tree, which then produces many more acorns. Yan smiled. Perhaps you do not associate oaks with China. We have many native species. The Chinese cork oak, as it is known, is, to my taste, a particularly attractive kind. Marlowe's eyes narrowed. Now you're trying to deflect us, aren't you? Well, here's another leak. What has mercury to do with it? Yan merely returned Marlowe's stare. At length, she said, May I have a glass of water? Still, please. The table water is sparkling. The cop murmured to the drone, then opened the door to allow it to fly off down the corridor once more. Tash said, I wasn't expecting that. Mercury? Planet Mercury? Mel looked at her, shrugged. We detected a space shot, a probe to Mercury, apparently disguised as a deep space comms link. A Chinese shot? Mel nodded. Tash glared. And you were going to tell us this when? Oh, Fred Bowles knows all about it, Charlie said. Hasn't filtered down to you yet. Mel shrugged. Sorry, kid. I don't know always what it's safe to talk about. All this damn secrecy, even between us. It's a wonder we get anything done at all. Marlowe shook her head. This is all hopelessly vague. Look, Yan. There was a subtle tap at the door. The cop opened it to admit the drone bearing more water on its tray. And it was accompanied by two armed Chinese soldiers. Ah, Tash said. Your asking for water was a signal. This meeting is over, said the cop, unsmiling. Wu Yan stood, eyes averted, and left the room. And Tash knew at that moment that the whole conference, which had barely begun, was going to fail. Shit, said the Astronomer Royal.